You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 220. Da Vinci always seemed like the prototype Tony Stark to me. David Goyer.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Well, guys, today we have a special episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. We are going to be airing an episode of the amazing screenwriting show, The Dialogue, that's available on indiefilmhustle.tv. And the guest is going to be David Goyer, the screenwriter behind films like Batman Begins, Dark Knight, the new series on Netflix, The Sandman, Terminator, Dark Fate, Godzilla, Man of Steel, Ghost Rider, and of course, the classic Jean-Claude Van Damme film, Death Warrant, among many other. Hey, we all got to start somewhere. And David sits down with legendary producer Mike DeLuca to talk about screenwriting, the craft, the business. And I thought this would be a really great introduction to this amazing series called The Dialogue, which again is available, as if you're a member, on Indie Film Hustle TV. So if you want to watch this episode and 32 other episodes with some of the greatest screenwriters working today, all you need to do is go to indiefilmhustle.tv and sign up for a membership. But without any further ado, here is your preview of the Dialogue series with David Goyer.
I'm Mike DeLuca. Welcome to this rare In the Trenches look at the craft of screenwriting. Today, I'm sitting here with the Prince of Darkness, writer, producer, director David Goyer, the man behind Batman Begins, the Blade series, Dark City, Crow City of Angels, Flash, and a thousand other movies I'm probably forgetting. How'd you get so busy? And welcome.
Thanks for having me. How'd I get so busy? I'm a workaholic, I guess.
Well, let me put it this way. What do you think was the beginning of this kind of current wave of superhero movies?
The first really significant comic book movie was the Richard Donner Superman film in 1978. The next really significant one was Tim Burton's Batman film. But they didn't really open the floodgates in terms of all these other superhero movies. And that really happened with the first Blade film that you and I did, actually. And the reason for that, I guess, is because aside from the Batman and Superman franchises over at DC being somewhat dormant, Marvel itself was in bankruptcy.
Right.
And I remember the very first meeting we had for Blade was the first day that Avi Arad, who's now the head of Marvel,
right,
you know, got on the job. And what was significant about that film is it wasn't a well-known property. It wasn't the jewel of Marvel's crown. It was right. A C-list character that didn't even have his own comic book. And it was significant because there was always this assumption that you can make comic book movies out of maybe five characters over DC and five over Marvel, and that was it. Mm-hmm. But they realized with Blade, this totally C-list character, oh my God, this character in and of itself can generate a $300 million franchise. And oh my God, we've got 9,000 characters. It's just a free-for-all.
Right.
And that's proven to be the case. I mean, you know, now Marvel's got, well, with the advent of Fantastic Four, at least four ongoing significant superhero franchises.
Right. Well, I think what you proved with the director of Blade, Steve Norrington, is that it wasn't so much you needed a known character, but there was a certain attitude and you know, humor and irreverence and modernity reflected in Marvel comics that you guys brought to the screen that that had been absent in any of the previous Marvel adaptations.
There was that, and there was also prior to, you know, some of the sort of comic book movies that had been made prior to that, Dick Tracy, things like that, there was always the assumption that they would be, you know, the production design would be in these primary colors, and that would, they would be comic booky,
right,
if you will. And what the Blade films did, and the X-Men films, and the Spider-Man films did, and more recently with Batman Begins, is they treated the subject matter seriously. It wasn't a kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge going on with the audience.
Right.
And, you know, the filmmakers weren't, they weren't looking down on the subject matter.
Right. The fans have always said, we want this kind of Batman. They showed up for Tim Burton's Batman. They showed up for your Batman and Chris Nolan's Batman. Why did the studio, why did they have to get bitch slapped twice to go back to something that the fans have continually said, not just comic book fans, but moviegoers, we want it to be treated seriously. Not that it has to be dour, but we want it appropriately treated. Characters lasted for 75 years. Why did they let it drift into camp?
I think it's a generational thing. I mean, first of all, the public's conception of Batman, and this is specific to Batman, aside from the fans, is the 60s TV show.
You think that's true, though? Do you think that really represents Batman to a big group? Because
I do.
Where are those people who want that Batman? I've never run into one of those people.
I don't think they want it,
right,
but I think that that's what they think of as Batman.
Right.
And so my grandmother, my uncle, my mother, they didn't read comic books. They don't know the Dark Knight from,
right,
you know, whatever. But the other thing I think is that it's a generational thing. I think what's happening now with filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro and, you know, Singer and Nolan and, you know, Sam Raimi and
Proyas
to a lesser extent, you know, myself, we all grew up actually being weaned on these comic books. We loved them. We sort of, you know, ate, breathed, and slept them.
Right.
And again, we weren't looking down at the material. And I think it took that generation of filmmakers to come of age in order to really treat them seriously for the studios to get it.
Like a generational thing.
Exactly.
Do you think the special effects coming of age also has enabled more adaptations? Because they just simply weren't there 20 years ago.
There are things that are possible now,
right,
that they simply couldn't do. It would have made for a $300 million movie or something,
right,
like that.
Like Spider-Man swinging through the canyons. There's no way it could
have done. Yeah, how would they have done that in the 70s or the 80s?
Right.
It would have looked like those TV movies that they did.
Right. Where does Prince of Darkness come from?
Prince of Darkness, well, originally...
You're a nice guy.
I am a nice guy.
You love children and pets.
Bunny rabbits and sunsets and long walks on the beach. A high school teacher dubbed me that. And somehow I was doing some interview with Premier Magazine and that stuck. And then they did an article. And then in the lame way that other, you know...
Things
articles
stick.
And magazines. Yeah, they're just suddenly he's the Prince of Darkness. So
now, did you get tatted up as a response to the name?
No.
Trying to live up to it? Or no, what's the story behind those?
I got my first tattoo the week after I sold my first script when I was 22 years old, sort of in defiance. Back then, tattoos weren't as prevalent. And I thought, oh, I'm you know, going to be a rebel and never commit to a real job.
Right.
Funny anecdote, though. I thought I would be all writerly and get a saying tattooed on my bicep from a poem, Not Drowning But Waving. And the tattoo artist misspelled the word drowning. So my tattoo says Not Drowing But Waving. So I'm a professional writer with a spelling error tattooed on my body.
That's pretty ironic.
Yeah.
What attracts you to dark material over things that might be more like fantastical or escapist or a little lighter?
I mean, I like seeing lighter fare. But clearly the kind of themes that I'm attracted to, I mean, every movie I've ever done with the exception of Batman Begins has been R-rated.
Mm-hmm.
And Batman Begins is certainly, I think, about as dark a PG-13 film as you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly people were surprised at how dark it was. And I mean, I'm really interested in anti-heroes. I'm really interested in characters that are conflicted. I'm interested in characters that have to sort of go to a dark place and people that are alienated and whatnot, probably because I'm sure there's a little bit of my own experience as a kid or something like that in there as well.
Does it require a different skill set to make a comic book believable on screen, or is it writing is writing?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it is a different skill set. I mean, it depends on whether or not you're adapting Ghost World,
mm-hmm,
but say you're adapting a superhero comic book. If it's a well-known character, Spider-Man,
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Batman, Superman, there's a canon, there's a known lore, and you have to be very careful about what you choose to change or not change. And I'd like to think, because of my background reading comics and also writing comic books, that in the case of Batman, I had a good handle on, you know, what was sacred and what could be modified a bit. And I would maintain that some of the comic book movies that have been made that aren't successful are the ones that veer too far away from the source material. I mean, Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, the X-Men movies, they stick pretty close to the source material. When you're dealing with a lesser known character like Blade, you've got more latitude. There aren't a lot of people out there that are, you know, specifically aware of Blade's origin.
Was that prevalent in your mind, your mind and Chris Nolan's mind, the fans had making sure you were reverent enough, but not so reverent that we've all seen it before? Like, was that a big consideration into the drafting of the story?
Yeah, we had to walk this thin line between delivering something for the fans, which obviously are the core audience, but they're not going to be enough to make a movie of that budget successful in and of its own right, and sort of the broader mass audience. And the problem was the core fans, you know, ever since Frank Miller and Alan Moore and things like that, they were used to a very dark depiction of Batman, Dark Knight.
Right.
But the mass audience wasn't used to it. And I mean, even Burton's first Batman film, which I enjoyed, still had a fair amount of whimsy.
Sure.
And then they got progressively nuttier and you know, more like Starlight Express by the time they were done. And they started to become like the old Batman show. And so we had to also make sure with the mainstream audience that we just didn't completely shock them.
Right.
But it was definitely a juggling act.
The last Schumacher one was interesting because they did become like the TV show, but no one told Batman. Like, Batman was still played fairly straight by Clooney or like, no one told the lead guy we're making a comedy.
But they were actually quoting lines from the old show, like, holy rusty metal. It was some misspawn perversion, I don't know.
Now, you've made this the transition from writer to director. When you directed Blade 3, how did you adjust to things like pacing and action and shooting big action? I know you had done Zigzag before. Was it a big transition or was it an easier leap than you would have thought?
It was a big transition, but since I had been involved in the other two movies, on the first Blade film as a writer, on the second Blade film as a writer and a producer, I mean, certain things had already been sketched out. I was aware of, you know, various pitfalls and things like that. So I think the leap was not as difficult as it might have been for somebody just coming in having never had any experience with that whatsoever. But look, directing drama is significantly different than directing visual effects or things like that.
Right.
And they're sort of two different skill sets. And, you know, especially when you're doing a chase scene or something like that in the third Blade film where we also had a second unit and we're literally storyboarding and divvying up shots and whatnot. And it's definitely different. I also found, ironically enough, with the third Blade film, that I as a director veered away from my own script more than Guillermo del Toro or Stephen Norrington did, which is kind of ironic.
Right. It was easier for you to kill some of your children to get the better movie.
Well, that's the other thing that happens when you go from the transition of writing to directing. I mean, as a writer, sometimes you get in these arguments with a director and the director will say, look, I'm on the location, or I'm come down here. I don't know how to shoot this the way you wrote it. Or you say, you know, I remember one time in a script I had some description of, you know, a bad guy or something like that as being like the I don't know, like I described him as like the primordial face of evil, you know, and the director said, that sounds great, but how the fuck do I, what is that? And I realized, and sometimes I would argue with Norrington or Del Toro or even Alex Proyas or whatnot, and say, but why aren't you shooting exactly what's on the page? Why are you changing that? And they would say, because this doesn't cut with this. And I didn't really get that until I was on the set, having sort of boxed myself into a corner as a writer. And now as the director, thinking to myself, oh, yeah, I get that now.
Right.
There's a practicality involved. I mean, the script is obviously important and everything comes from the script. but it is the blueprint. It's sometimes you get on location and the location's different than you had anticipated, or you run out of time, or the actor has some kind of problem and won't come out of his or her trailer for 6 hours,
right,
or whatever it is.
You sound like you've had some experience with
that.
Oh,
yeah, we've had experience like that before. You know, and then sometimes you'll get there, and this has happened to me as a writer, as a director, as a producer, and a star will say, I'm not saying that line.
Right.
But you need to say that line because this connects to this. I don't care. That's your problem. I'm not saying that line.
Right. It's very different than being the writer in a room writing your script.
Exactly.
Suddenly you're out there having to explain everything.
Exactly. Or justify something, or, you know.
So now, do you think you'll be directing your own material from now on? Except for Batman.
Funnily enough, the next movie I'm about to direct, I did not write.
Okay.
So the one after that will be The Flash.
What's the one you're going to direct that you
The one
write?
I'm going to direct next is called The Invisible. It's a remake of a Swedish film. And once again, it's a dark drama.
Right.
About a murder in a high school. But I just thought it would be interesting transitioning into directing to do something that I didn't write. I mean, for me, I thought, well, if I get a script with someone else's voice and then I interpret it, that marriage might be interesting. And frankly, that's why Chris Nolan approached me to do Batman, because he thought, well, your voice is so different than mine, and I think the combination of the two will make for a better film.
Right. Do outlines play a big part in your process in the beginning of a script? Do you kind of beat out the whole story?
Yeah.
Or just dive in after page one and wing it?
The few times I've tried to dive in, you just become hopelessly lost around page
right.
40 and just fall into despair and
right.
start drinking. Yeah, outlines are a big part. I, for myself, usually write, you know, a 30-40 page outline.
Okay, fairly detailed.
I never give them to the studio.
Right.
In my whole career, I've never given an outline to studios. It's the worst. They always ask for it.
What do you say when they ask? I mean, I know the answer because we asked. I didn't ask personally, but I know it was asked of you.
Right. I say fuck off. but I've reached a certain pinnacle, and I say that jokingly.
Mm-hmm.
I have a certain place in my career where I can say that now.
Right.
But, you know, obviously young writers can't. I mean, what I'll usually do is I'll say, I will come into you and I will verbally pitch you
right.
everything that's in the outline, and I'll take an hour to take you through everything. But the problem with the outline as a format for studios to read, it's I think Terry Rossio has a website. He's another writer.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote Pirates of the Caribbean with his partner. And it's the worst possible format to get your ideas across
right.
because it's sort of longer than just, you know, a
right.
synopsis. And it's sort of long enough to raise questions, but you don't have the dialogue in there to execute. In some cases, if they had read the scene, mm-hmm. you know, they would be
right.
they wouldn't be confused, or it's all in the execution.
So you end up getting notes on the outline as opposed
yeah,
to
Yeah, you get notes on the outline and it's terrible. And so basically it's the worst format to try to present your ideas in because it's not the whole scene. And they always try to get you to do it, and it's always a disaster.
Right. So what happens? Chris Nolan calls you and says, I want you to work on the new Batman for me. I know you're a big fan of Batman, so that must have been something that made you very happy.
Yeah.
And then the two of you immediately got to work breaking the back of that story. Kind of?
Yeah. Yeah. That was an amazing experience because Chris and I worked in a complete vacuum. And, you know, we got together for a couple of weeks and worked out the basics of the story. Then I went off and wrote an outline, 30 mm-hmm. to 40 pages. Just for Chris and myself, never went into the studio. Chris went in and briefly pitched it to the head of the studio. I wrote the first draft, then Chris did some work on it, then I came back and did it. Then it kind of went back
right.
and forth. But the amazing thing in that instance is they were so paranoid about secrecy and whatnot that the studio, A, greenlit the movie on the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
And the only two people that read it initially were Jeff Robinoff and Alan Horn, the two heads,
the heads of the studio. Right.
And they came to Chris's house to read it.
Right.
The script never went into the studio. And we started pre-production for a good 2 months. And people would only come to the house to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fake title. It was called The Intimidation Game. And all the documents, all the legal documents.
Said The Intimidation
said
Game.
The Intimidation Game, because they were worried about a Superman and Superman scripted when Brett Ratner was doing it,
right.
it leaked online and it had generated some negative feedback.
Right.
They were very concerned about that.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
But then, again, a little funny sidebar is, Chris and I went to New York to meet with DC Comics for three days to sort of get their blessing on what we were doing.
Now, were they like abused children? But
Yeah.
I imagine, remember when Marvel, when we got to them, they were all suspicious of movie companies, and I imagine poor DC must have been the same way.
Yeah, DC was, when we came in...
There's still nipples on the bat suit.
Yeah, yeah. They were terrified. And when we came in and presented what we wanted to do, Paul Levitz said, thank God, he's the head of DC Comics, and he gave us our blessing. But when we checked into our hotels, what's funny about this is Warner Travel had put on all the itineraries Batman Begins, and that's how it leaked.
Right. They blew their own cover.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
I know you've made an independent movie, you've worked at a mini major, you know, New Line, and now you've worked with big studios. Are there major differences between your process for independent, for mini major, for major? Was dealing with Warner Brothers tremendously different than dealing with New Line or the ZigZag experience?
Every situation is different. In the case of ZigZag, the independent film I had written and directed, it was a negative pickup. So we were given a set amount of money and just, you know, sent away to make the movie and then come back. And there's absolutely no interference. And I had final cut and blah, blah, blah. In the case of the mini majors, I was lucky in that I primarily dealt with you.
Mm-hmm. And I hear good things about me.
Yeah. And you and I got along and, you know, and to a lesser degree, another executive that used to be there, Brian Whitten. And we had a good relationship, and you and I obviously had the same sort of points of reference.
And we knew what we wanted the character to be, which is so important to know. All swim in the same direction on something.
Yeah. You know, in the case of Warner Brothers, they knew that the Batman franchise had been sorely damaged.
Right.
And that they had to do something significant in order to resurrect it and to go in a different direction. Right. And they knew...
They were like Ellen Burstyn in The Exorcist, and you were like Jason Miller.
Yes.
And the franchise was Linda Blair.
Yes, exactly. And there was projectile vomiting in both cases.
Right.
But they knew that they had to sort of give it credibility again. And so when they announced that Chris and I were going to do it together, I think there was somewhat of a collective sigh of relief.
Right.
You know, amongst the fans that, oh, wow, I guess they're serious about reinventing this.
Now, were you aware of the rumors about the Superman versus Batman project? Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think that that's a kind of an unmakeable movie?
I think eventually it's a good idea. I mean, the thing about Superman versus Batman, the script was written by Andrew Kevin Walker, who we both know.
But that's a script kept on the lock and key. Like, I've just heard about it, but I haven't read it.
Oh, I've read it. It's actually a great script. And, but I think, you know, Warner Brothers, they've been trying to revive the Superman and the Batman franchise for years. Mm-hmm. And they were getting nowhere. And there were all these different iterations of things. And kind of in despair, they said, well, let's do it this combo movie, sort of like what Universal had done
with
Frankenstein and the Wolfman. Let's just throw them all into the same movie and, you know, see what happens. But the problem with that is by making that movie, you're basically admitting that you've exhausted all possibilities with the franchise. And I don't know whether it's Alan Horn or Jeff Robinow, but they said...
You can always make that movie.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, hopefully now... I mean, I think they, with Bryan Singer and Chris Nolan, I think they have successfully pressed reset on those two franchises, and they can probably get three or four more movies out of each and then make Batman versus Superman.
Right. Now, how did... They approach you about the Flash? Like, did you get a phone call and say we want? Or did you go to them and say?
No, after Batman Begins, Warner Brothers owns DC Comics, and they'd obviously had a good experience on that, and so they came to me and said, which was fun for especially for comic book geek like me, and said, any DC character you want, what do you want to do? We want to do another.
Right.
They were primarily pushing Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, or The Flash.
Mm-hmm.
I had no particular love for Wonder Woman. And I just thought The Flash would be fun and that no one had really exploited those powers, you know, cinematically yet. So that's what I'm working on right now.
And when you sit down and begin to write a movie like The Flash or any movie that you've worked on, do you think in pictures first and then words or words first?
In the case of The Flash, I did something similar to what I'd done in Batman. The first thing I did was just sat down, locked myself in a room for a week, and just reread everything I could possibly reread. And I did two things. A, I made a list of just cool moments or lines in no particular order that I just thought had to be in the movie.
Right.
And then I also made a list of, you know, what if you boil the Flash, or you boil Batman down, or you boil Blade down, what are the elements that absolutely have to be there? What's the story about? What's the, you know, in the case of Batman, obviously there are core elements that have to be there. But in terms of the theme, you know, it was a story about fear and overcoming your fear and living in the shadow of your father and being afraid that you're not going to, you know, fulfill, you know, his, what he was trying to do and, you know, honor his memory. In the case of the Flash, I had to do the same thing and figure out what's the metaphor? What's the theme of this movie? And what I decided for the Flash, should we be fortunate enough to make it, is it's the Icarus myth in a way that speed is the only modern vice. You know, there's all these vices that exist time immemorial, but speed is something relatively new,
right?
And it's addictive. And, you know, if you run too fast, you'll run yourself literally out of existence, but you'll also sort of won't be able to stop and smell the roses, and you'll leave the people you love behind. And so that's sort of the emotional core of what I'm trying to do with The Flash.
In terms of themes, are there themes that you like to explore over other ones? I know you mentioned the anti-hero, but are there themes in The Flash that are similar to some of the themes in your other work?
Well, I mean, in a lot of cases, I seem to tell stories about either reluctant heroes or heroes who, you know, I mean, in the case of Blade, he's acting heroically, but sort of the rest of the world thinks he's a vigilante, as is the case with Batman. In the case of Dark City, it's again sort of a hero acting alone that's isolated and whatnot. I don't think I would actually ever be good to write Superman because it's the opposite.
He's angst-free.
Yeah, and I wouldn't know the angle because I'm so angst-ridden that, you know, I wouldn't know what to do with a character like that.
Right. Give him angst.
Right. Well, in the case of The Flash, the Wally West character, I mean, his angst is that he's a screw-up.
Right.
He's just he's like the last person that you know, he gets these powers and the first thing he does is he just messes around.
Was Wally West Kid Flash?
Yeah. And then around 1980, 1981,
he became
The Flash. And so for the bulk of the major generation of filmgoers that would be seeing that movie,
it's Wally West.
He's been Wally West.
Okay. You mentioned Dark City, which is another film we worked on together. It's kind of become a cult favorite, but it's an odd movie. What were the biggest challenges in putting a movie like that together? Was that an idea that you collaborated with Alex on?
Alex Poise had the initial idea.
Okay.
He had a treatment that he sent me that was amazing but incomprehensible.
Right.
And he knew it. And he said at the time, you know, I want you to sort of make a movie out of this with me. And he directed The Crow, but it hadn't come out and I hadn't seen it.
Right.
So there was nothing to go on. And I just thought, this is crazy. I turned it down. He went off, eventually found Lem Dobbs. They did a draft. And Lem is great. But Lem is also not known for writing.
Right.
You know, the guy that wrote Kafka.
Lem wrote The Limey, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Limey's great. But if you've got a kind of inscrutable Chinese box of a movie, the guy that wrote Kafka may not be
your guy.
The best guy to kind of, you know, make it a little less
accessible.
Or more accessible. And so eventually I came back on and my whole point with Dark City was I said to Alex, you've got all these. It takes place in kind of this parallel universe.
Right.
You've got all these weird rules, and it's fine for this universe to have different rules. They just have to be consistent rules.
Right.
So we just had to, there was no consistency in anything that was happening.
Right. So a big challenge was to make everything conform to one set of rules. So then you could suspend your disbelief and go with it.
Right. And it had a dream kind of logic, but I just said, we just have to kind of codify what these rules are. And, you know, the first scene I wrote for Dark City, I pointed out to Alex kind of something that I thought was obvious, which was, you know, the city always takes place at night, but no one ever comments on it.
Right.
That there is no daylight or that there, you know.
Right.
And I just thought, well.
They might mention that.
Yeah. That's like a big deal. So the first scene I wrote that movie with Alex kind of out of order. And the first scene I did was this scene between, the protagonist.
The Murdoch character.
Yeah, the Murdoch character and Bumstead.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Who's played by William Hurt. And it's, he's being interrogated and there's this moment where he says, let me ask you a question to Bumstead. Do you remember daylight? And that turned out to be kind of the pivotal scene in the movie.
No, that got the existential thing going in the movie. In a movie with big ideas like that, you have to fight for space with trying to get those themes in, but also have like character work and great one-liners or,
Well, the thing about Dark City that was kind of nice is we were deliberately trying to do a movie that forced the audience to think.
Right.
And
boy, did we get bit in the ass for that.
Yeah, you did. You did. But the other problem with Dark City, even though it's a movie that I dearly love, is that it's a movie about a guy with amnesia who sort of doesn't find himself and become more active a protagonist until the end of the movie. Last 15 minutes of the movie, Rufus Sewell is pretty cool.
Right.
But it's kind of hard to make a movie about a guy with amnesia when you cast an unknown. Before that, there was this moment where we were going to have Johnny Depp.
Right.
With Johnny Depp playing a guy with amnesia, he's still Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got
Rufus
a movie starring an unknown, and nobody knows who he is, and there's nothing to imbue with. But another funny anecdote, we shot that movie in Sydney, Australia, and you don't like to fly. And so no one from New Line would ever come over to check on us because we were off in bumfuck part of the world.
Well, the ultimate irony is now as a producer, I just spent 7 months
in Australia. You had to go to Australia, yeah. I know.
That scene in Dark City between Bumstead and Murdoch is a very pivotal scene, and it kind of sets the tone for that existential debate. Was that a difficult scene to come up with? I mean, once you had it, it fit in great, but did you guys struggle with that one?
No, we really didn't. It's the first scene I wrote. I sat home one night, or actually I was in Sydney at the time, and I wrote that scene, and we never changed it from that initial draft, mm-hmm. that scene. The trick of Dark City was that it was a Chinese box of a movie, and so many things retroactively had to make sense. And we had these flow charts set up, and Alex and I were just constantly getting lost in our own logic.
Right.
But that was part of the fun of doing it.
In terms of your own writing, have you ever looked to other screenwriters for advice or to have other writers read your stuff? Or have you ever gotten really bad advice that puts you on the wrong path? Or do you not open yourself up for that kind of?
Well, I mean, I do have people read my work before I turn it into studios. Mm-hmm. I've got 4 or 5 friends. Some of them are writers that read it. A more recent friend of mine, Mark Protasevich, who you've also worked with, wrote The Cell. He and I have taken to, when we write similar kinds of things, we give each other our drafts and give each other feedback. And it's very easy for Mark or myself reading his stuff to see kind of obvious plot holes that maybe other people might, he'll call me up and say, you're kind of fudging it here.
Right.
And he'll keep me honest and I'll keep him honest. I think that's important as a writer to have, critical minds looking at your stuff and, telling you if it's not good enough.
Right. When did you decide to be a screenwriter? Was it always that for you or did you come to it?
I was going to be a homicide detective in Michigan. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I had been accepted to Michigan State and I was going to get a degree in police administration and become a homicide detective. And some of my high school teachers just flipped out and called up my mother and said, we think he should be a screenwriter, bizarrely.
Wow. Like specifically screenwriter?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I'd made little 8mm films in high school and they handed her the application for the USC BFA program.
Wow.
And, and I had never read a screenplay. I didn't know anyone in Hollywood. It's so much easier now for people becoming screenwriters.
Right.
There weren't any screenwriting programs. I didn't have a computer. Now you can get all sorts of scripts online.
Right.
There's Final Draft and there's books on screenwriting and things like that. And digital video cameras.
Right.
But I didn't have any of that crap. And to my surprise, I was accepted to USC and decided to go. And upon arriving at USC, was promptly kicked out of beginning screenwriting for arguing too much with my teacher.
And what was the point of contention?
The point of contention was he said that you could only tell a narrative story with a living person or animal or something in an animated film. He said you can't tell a narrative story with an inanimate object, which to me was ludicrous.
Right.
And I believe that short film Brave Little Toaster had come out that year.
Yeah, that Disney short.
Yeah. And I just said, that's bullshit. What, you're full of shit. And I remember I stood up on this table and stood, I don't know, it was ridiculous.
You led a riot.
Yeah, and he kicked me out.
And what about the high school teachers who put you on the path? Did you ever talk to them? And
I stayed in touch with them. And I had a nice experience a few years back, about 3 years ago, after I directed my first film, Zigzag. University of Michigan invited me back to kind of do a master class or whatever. And we had a screening of Zigzag at there's one movie palace back in Ann Arbor. And tickets were free to any teachers, former teachers or students from my high school. And like they all showed up and that was kind of cool.
Was there a particular moment where you gained full confidence of your skills as a screenwriter where you didn't, you know, I don't know if you ever had doubts, but was there a moment where you're like, I got it. This is going to work.
Yeah, actually, it was the script for Blade.
Okay.
I mean, I had been writing professionally for at least 5 years before that. And, you know, looking back on it, I look at some of the stuff I had written and even gotten made and said, God, I can't
believe. Pretty good Van Damme movie.
Yeah.
I bought.
Yeah, but that's
before
like,
Blade,
that's
right.
Like saying, you know, I don't know what you say. Like, it's the best Steven Seagal movie. Okay, great. Or it's the best Dolph Lundgren.
Everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first thing I'd done, which was this Van Damme movie, Death Warrant. But I think Blade was maybe the eighth or ninth script I had written.
Okay.
And it was the first time that I felt like everything just clicked.
Right.
And for me, prior to Blade, even though I wrote the script, it took about 4 years for the film to be made.
Right.
Prior to Blade, I was still auditioning for jobs. I really had to pitch myself really hard. And what was interesting with Blade, and this can happen with screenwriters, is the movie hadn't been made, but it had become this sort of infamous script that was circulating around town that people really liked. And it happens every once in a while. And you can make a name for yourself on something that even doesn't get made. Mm-hmm. And after Blade, I, for the first time, just got offered projects without having to audition for them.
That one script that kind of breaks through and is the writing sample, the magic writing sample for writers, things change after.
Yeah, and the script for Blade changed my career.
What about film school? Do you think it does anything for anyone? And did you pick up stuff at USC that was beneficial?
I mean, I clearly did. In my case, I knew nothing about filmmaking or screenwriting, and I was just coming from Michigan. So obviously I learned something. But nowadays with the internet and all these other tools, I don't know that it's entirely necessary to go to film school. I mean, there's so many filmmakers that didn't go to film school that are successful. And just the whole aspect of filmmaking is so much more accessible to people now.
Yeah. Anyone with a Mac can produce a Pixar movie.
Final Cut Pro or whatever it is. You know?
Right.
I mean, that guy that made that film at Sundance, Tarnation, I don't know if you ever saw that, but he made it for thousands of dollars.
Right. No, I saw Primer, though, which was
Primer was great. It was made for $7,000, and that's like a really engrossing movie.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, anybody can put together $7,000.
How much is tuition per year?
Oh, God. I mean, even back then, it was $25,000 a year or something.
Right.
So it's $100,000. I mean.
No, I'd rather make the $7,000 movie and end up at Sundance.
But then again, you know, there's only one of those a year for five. I don't know how many films that get submitted.
Thousands.
You know, it's like winning the lottery.
Right. Is there anything in your life that prepared you for life as a screenwriter or a screenwriter director in Hollywood? Like, is there one quality you're towing from way back when that gave you an edge out here?
No, there's no quality. I mean, writers come from all walks of life. And I used to think that you had to be tortured to be a good artist. And I think to a certain extent that's true, that whether you're a musician or a screenwriter or a director or a novelist, that oftentimes if you've had a really idyllic childhood, what you produce is somewhat boring because you haven't had any adversity or any conflict in your life. It doesn't mean you have to be miserable now.
Right.
But there was a certain amount of adversity or things that I had to deal with as a child. And as is often the case with writers, you get into that as an escape.
Right.
You know, you don't want to deal with whatever it is that's going on. So you write stories, or you draw comic books, or you write songs. And, you know, if everything was hunky-dory and dandy, you know, you'd be out.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
On the stickball team, or, you know,
right,
whatever.
Did you have to write a lot of screenplays before your first produced one?
My first produced movie was my second screenplay.
Okay.
So I didn't have to write a lot. And I was one of those sickening guys that I sold my first script about 6 months after I graduated college and
right,
didn't have much in the way of a real job and have no idea what I would do if I didn't do this. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I don't have any applicable skills.
Right. Do the skills that you refine over the course of writing a lot of screenplays, does it result in a better one each time out?
I think that writing is something that you can continue to get better at 30, 40, 50, 60 years. You know, I mean, I think unless you're suffering from Alzheimer's or something right, like that. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'd like to think, put it this way. When I wrote Blade, I looked back at the scripts prior to that and thought they were crap.
Right.
And then when I wrote Batman Begins, I looked back at Blade and thought Blade was crap.
Right.
Now, I hope 5 years from now that whatever I'm writing at the time, I look back at it and think Batman Begins is
right,
crap, because that means I'm evolving and
right,
continuing to kind of hone my craft.
Did you know that films like Puppet Masters or Death Warrant were a good way into the business? That
no,
there were movies people were going to make, they were going to probably make a profit?
No. When I started out, I mean, everybody's different. I was just trying to first, make a living
right,
as a writer. And then it was, okay, now let's try to get something made. Yeah, I mean, the bar kept on being raised.
Right.
And then let's try to get something good made. And, I've had a lot of things made. I've had, I think, feature-wise, something like 17 things made. And I'm lucky enough, I remember a teacher in film school said, look, making a good movie is so incredibly difficult that as a screenwriter, if at the end of your career you can look back and feel that there's even one movie you're truly proud of, you should consider yourself a success. Well, I can look back between TV and movies now and say there's maybe seven or eight that I'm proud of. And, you know, I've got seven or eight that I'm embarrassed by and
right,
seven or eight that I'm indifferent to.
Right.
I've also got a fair number of things made that I've written under pseudonyms,
right,
which is something kind of fun.
Now, what caused that?
Well, if you have enough crappy things made, the problem with writing for film is that you are at the mercy of the director.
Right.
And I mean, I've been fortunate enough to work with a lot of good directors, but I've also worked with a lot of crappy directors.
Right. And that's where you'd use the pseudonym?
Yeah. Well, at the beginning of your, I wish I could retroactively go back in time.
Right.
Put a pseudonym on Kickboxer 2 or Demonic Toys or something like that. But,
right,
but I didn't. But once I kind of got wise to that, I've used a pseudonym 3 or 4 times.
What is your pseudonym?
Oh, I have a bunch of them. I have a Cynthia Verlaine. I have Ricardo.
Does she come out at night and
yeah,
tickle your chin?
I have Ricardo Festiva. And
now, do the studios know, or do the people know?
Yeah, you have to
okay,
let the studio know that this is you're using a
okay,
pseudonym, and then I also have Yushiro Tegubadori. So those are the three so far, and I have another one that I registered that I've yet to use, Flex Gamble. So who knows?
He's on deck.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a film that you thought was going to sail into production, not go into production, never go into production, and was there one thing that stopped it from happening?
That's the thing. I mean, you learn in this business that anything can happen. I mean, all the time
right,
you meet with producers or studios, and they say, you don't understand. We're making this movie. You know, and
right,
cut to, we're not making this movie.
Right.
I had a movie once that the plug was pulled 8 days before shooting, which is very late in the game. Sometimes there are movies the plug's pulled in the middle of shooting.
What was the what caused the 8-day plug to be pulled?
I think it was casting, and you know, they just ultimately decided, is this movie worth it or something like that. Then now that movie was ultimately made as a TV movie, and Cynthia Verlaine wrote that movie.
I see. How do you know when to really give them a fight and when to pick your battles? Like, what, how do you know when to really throw, to fall on your sword for a point of view or a project? Or
that's a hard one, especially as you're starting out, because you know, there are a couple different factors involved. I mean, first of all, if you're a beginning writer and you're too difficult or too argumentative, you'll ultimately write yourself out of jobs because people say he's just too much of a, he or she is just too much of a pain in the ass.
But they want the point of view too, probably, right?
They do want the point of view, but then the other thing that happens is as you become more successful, you've got a body of work so you can speak with more authority and throw yourself around. Now, I reached this aha experience where, I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago, I was given a set. The other thing is that you have to be open to the idea that to constructive criticism, that just because it's the studio doesn't mean that what they're saying isn't a good idea. Uh-huh. And you have to really challenge yourself and find this balance between listening to the criticism and possibly doing what they're saying and also fighting for your instincts. And there are cases where you could be in a room of people and all 10 of them are saying, don't do this. And you think, no, I should do the opposite. And you absolutely should stick to your guns.
Right.
And what I realized 10 years ago is if I really hate the notes and I really think that these notes just completely screw the integrity of the piece, I won't do them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll walk. And usually 9 times out of 10, that so freaks them out.
Right.
You know, I'll say, give back the money, whatnot. That I did it with you once. You were pissed at me.
Which one? Refresh my memory.
I did an early draft of Freddy versus Jason.
Ah, I don't remember it. No, I don't remember.
and I...
Was that when Rob Bottin was...
Yeah. Truth be told, I didn't really want to do the project to begin with. And you kind of talked me into it. And my heart wasn't in it. And we did a draft and it sucked. And I said it sucked. And, you know, you guys wanted me to do a certain amount of notes. And I just like...
Get me off this train.
Yeah, exactly. 10 years later, they made it.
Did you ever see the eventual movie?
Did I ever see it? The irony is, 10 years later, I ended up being boonswaggled into script doctoring the damn thing. I spent 5 weeks on that.
It was fated to be you and Freddy and Jason.
Yeah, exactly.
You're lucky they didn't draft you for the Freddy, Jason, Chucky, Ash from Evil Dead movie.
I know. But like every writer in town, like worked on Freddy versus Jason. I mean, there were 13 different scripts written and millions.
I think Cynthia Berlain took a shot.
Probably.
Now that you're directing your own material, did New Line trust you more because it's one-stop shopping for the vision? They dealt with you as a writer.
Yeah, I think New Line did trust me because I, in terms of things that had been made, I'd been involved in 5 or 6 things with New Line that had been made and maybe 10 things, you know, the other things that hadn't been made. So there was definitely a comfort level between us.
Mm-hmm. Have you turned down other assignments besides running away from Freddy versus Jason?
Oh, yeah. I turn down assignments all the time.
I know you turned me down again for Ghost Rider.
I did. I did turn you down for that.
Well, I guess, what is it? Your schedule, but also that you have to be turned on by the material.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, in that case, I actually could not do it.
Right.
Because I was about to direct a pilot, but I turn things down all the time. I mean, that's one of the nice things about hopefully becoming more successful is you can become progressively more selective.
Right.
And, you know...
Do you think you'll continue to be open to direct other people's scripts as well as writing?
Yeah. Well, we'll see what the experience is like after I do it, but I think so.
You're going to let the writer on the set?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's good to have the writer on the set because... It's important to have somebody who can protect the integrity of the story because when you are directing, you're shooting it out of order.
Right.
It's little pieces and you're overwhelmed by costume and continuity and the actor won't come out of their trailer and whatever it is that you're dealing with. And the actor might want to make some line modification and you're not thinking at the time, oh, but if I change that line, it's going to screw up this scene later on down the line.
Right.
But the writer is because the writer's got right it there. In his or her head. So I think that's important.
At this point in your career, what do you know what the best thing you've ever written is? Produced or not produced, but do you know the best thing ever?
The best thing ever written, I think, for me, produced, is Batman Begins so far. I think the best script I ever wrote, not yet produced, is an adaptation of a Neil Gaiman short story called Murder Mysteries. And that's admittedly something I hope to direct, but is more of a Dark City.
Right.
It's a much more challenging, not sort of down the middle movie.
Do you like you still like those complex narratives, those puzzle boxes?
I do.
Right.
I do. I mean, you do too. They're not always going to burn up the screen in terms of box office.
Right. I think what I learned is that we have very peculiar tastes and budget should be watched.
Yes. I mean, look.
Although we did have Matrix 2 seconds before Matrix.
I know. What's frustrating is the Matrix came out, a year later or something like that.
And with the, that's how you make that idea commercial.
Exactly.
I forgot how to
exactly.
do
that.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
This is a hard question to answer, but do you feel you have one weakness as a writer? I know you want to broadcast this to the studios.
I think that writers tend to gravitate, either they're more character writers or more plot writers. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a kind of a fundamental way that writers approach things.
Right.
And a lot of writers will write characters first and sort of see where those characters take them.
Right.
And a lot of other writers will work from a place of structure and plot and back into that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still difficult for me, I think, to write female characters mm-hmm. just because I don't have a vagina.
Right. they sell those down on Melrose.
Yeah.
The rubber wrap.
That's still difficult for me mm-hmm. sometimes.
What do you do to improve in that area, knowing that that's a weakness? I mean, do you seek?
Go down to Melrose.
Do you talk to women about characters when you're writing a script with female?
Yeah, and characters? You say, "Will you read this? Can you see if it rings true mm-hmm. or not?" And you try to do whatever research you can.
Right. No, actually, the Katie Holmes character in Batman Begins and Nebuchadnezzar Wright and Blade were both pretty strong female characters.
Yes, and I like writing strong mm-hmm. female characters. But I'm aware of the fact that I don't want to make them too strident or too,
right.
look, I'm not, I think I can do it. It's just something that I.
That's one area you think, yeah.
Yeah.
You and Oliver Stone. was there a point in Batman Begins where you guys hit a roadblock and it took you a little bit of time to bust through it? Was anything difficult in the refashioning of that myth?
I remember saying to Chris at one point, near the end of the second act of the film, that it would be great if there were a certain amount of symmetry if Ra's al Ghul, when he comes back, could burn down Wayne Manor.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking that, that would be something the audience wouldn't expect because it's not in the canon.
Right.
I think, well, they're not going to destroy Wayne Manor because we know Wayne Manor continues and exists. But I know it seems obvious now, but it took us months
to figure out how
just to figure out, well, they can rebuild it.
Oh.
I mean, it's like, duh.
Right. Well, that's how reverently you treated the canon. If in your mind that house always existed, and if you tear it down, it's gone.
Right.
Right.
But then we thought, but that then fits with the theme of the movie of rebuilding Gotham.
Right. And you managed to get in a few lines about, that imply that they can make improvements to the
cave.
Exactly.
To build a better bat cave and things like that. And,
right.
I mean, I think that the was also trying to figure out the machinations of getting Ra's al Ghul back into Gotham and linking Ra's al Ghul and the League of Shadows into sort of having perhaps had a presence at Gotham before. Mm-hmm. And, that was a tricky movie to write.
Right.
Also because we were dealing with a nonlinear structure.
Right. You've worked in the same genre a lot. Have you ever cannibalized unproduced scripts for scripts that became produced scripts?
All the time. I mean,
they're yours, why not?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember utilizing a bit from, I wrote an unproduced script for Doctor Strange for Sony,
mm-hmm.
and I utilize that in another bit, or sometimes I'll come up with a line or, a scary sequence and cannibalize. You're allowed to copy from yourself, especially if it's never seen the light of day.
Where do you find inspiration for the stuff you come up with?
I'm a voracious reader. Oddly enough, I'm not a voracious consumer of movies.
Right.
I mean, I watch movies mm-hmm. and I watch TV, but I wouldn't even describe myself as a cinephile, but I do read constantly. And on my bed table, there's 4 or 5 books that I'm reading simultaneously. And I read all sorts of stuff.
Now, I know you like to think on your feet. So
yes.
We've got a little screenwriting exercise for you, and we call it the object.
My loins are yearning.
Norris, Trey. So here's what happens here.
Okay.
We're going to present you with an object. You're going to tell me its story in any way you see fit. And after that, you're going to tell me why you chose what you chose. Other than that, there are no rules, regulations, or limitations.
You bastard. Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Do you know what's going on?
I know it. I grok it.
Kick it.
Your object, sir.
God. Oh, God. Well, I mean, I see this and immediately I go to some kind of horror film.
Go.
You know, I mean, you know, this is just, you know, some guy, cop pursuing, you know, a killer or something like that in some godforsaken place that's been condemned and, you know, where the killer has taken 40 children and hideously murdered them. And, you know, this little object is sort of there when the guy finally kills the killer and somehow, I don't know.
So you've taken a child's toy, something built
well,
to
I am,
give joy.
Well, I am the Prince of Darkness, but I look at this toy and I think this is a disturbing toy.
Uh-huh.
Like that Jack in the Box where the monkey comes out, or you know, that thing,
right.
The monkey, that, and dolls, those kinds of things really scare me. And this little clown, and clowns are inherently scary as well, and just wrong. And so you've got like an old tin toy of a clown, and it just, it's disturb-o-matic. And I maintain that if you put this thing in like an empty room with, you know, holes in the wall and graffiti and stuff like that, and just some moonlight coming down on that, you'd be scared. And you'd say the souls of 40 murdered children have been, you know, consecrated into that little toy, and they're going to come out and terrify people later on. I don't know. I mean, I seriously, though, I look at this and I say, this is like,
right.
This is disturbing. I don't know why.
Right.
Maybe it's indicative of my fucked up childhood or something like that.
I had a fucked up childhood. I see a clown on a bike.
So this is just a this is just a benign object.
Well, I didn't write Batman Begins either.
Right. Well, that's true. But you wrote In the Mouth of Madness.
Please don't mention that.
And the most disturbing thing about the object is that I now have to have it sit there in front of me.
You can put it anywhere you want.
Really?
Yeah, okay. It's your object.
Okay.
One might say it's an object lesson.
Ooh.
So far, you've mentioned you wanted to be a cop, a homicide detective, not even just a cop, a homicide detective.
I was very interested in solving homicides as a kid.
You put this thing at the scene of a crime.
Yeah.
Not even a crime, child murder.
A homicide.
What's eating you, David?
What's eating me? I don't know. As a kid, I watched a lot of monster movies and a lot of, I would just inherently be drawn to.
You didn't get in the car with the creepy guy from the street,
no,
like Mr.
no,
River
I didn't,
style.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't. I didn't have a scout master. That
it's never too late.
Had me win a very specific right. merit badge. Mm-hmm. No, I.
Do you like to be scared? I mean, as a,
I do
as a
like
reader
to be scared.
Of horror
I love
fiction.
To be scared.
Okay.
I love the vicarious
right.
sort of, you know. I love that experience of seeing something that's absolutely terrifying. Or reading something that's absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare these days when I watch a movie or television that I myself am scared as
right.
an audience member. And I could probably count on one hand in the last decade or two decades, the movies that really scared me. But I vividly remember, for instance, seeing Alien
right.
for the first time and absolutely losing my shit
right.
as an 11-year-old. And then, you know, another just really disturbing movie is Don't Look Now.
Yes.
The end of Don't Look Now. And that's a movie, that movie's so disturbing. I remember showing it to a woman who broke up with me afterwards because she was just like, that's so terrible.
Have
like,
you ever used Salo to use a breakup?
Yeah, yeah. That's a good makeout film.
Yeah, if you're making out with pre-Kabbalah Madonna.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, Jacob's Ladder
mm-hmm.
scared me and unhinged me and disturbed me. And I think parts of 28 Days Later. And it's really hard to make a really scary movie, actually.
In Batman Begins, I thought it comes close to true horror in several sequences, but
mostly with the Scarecrow, I think.
Well, the one I'm thinking of is the Scarecrow has inhaled his own hallucinogenic.
Yeah.
And what Nolan put on screen is his hallucinogenic version of Batman, you know, threatening Scarecrow was truly horrific.
Well, that was the epiphany that, you know, when I was talking with Chris and we were first talking about the story, I said it always bothered me in the Batman comic books and things like that that there'd be some scene where the guy would flop down a newspaper and it would be some man on the street's description of a giant bat. And
right.
the artist's, you know, rendition yeah. was a giant bat. And I'm like, he doesn't look like a giant bat. So I was saying to Chris, what are we going to do? Because he doesn't look like a bat.
Right.
He looks like a guy that's going to a costume ball or something
right.
like that. So then I realized, oh my God, the Scarecrow uses this hallucinogen. And the idea of having the Scarecrow himself see his, that came later. But when we realized that we were going to gas Gotham, I thought, holy crap, we have this opportunity to ever so briefly show Batman from
the fear point of view.
And he does look like this horrific demon. And that is what cements Batman's reputation in Gotham.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
From where the legend spreads, because hundreds of thousands of people, or at least thousands of people, saw a giant flying demonic bat.
Right.
Because they were all high. They were all tripping.
Right.
You know? And then we backed into the idea of the Scarecrow seeing Batman in the same way.
Taste of your own medicine, Doctor. What have you been doing here? Who are you working for? Ra's al Ghul. Ra's al Ghul is dead. Who are you working for? Dr. Crane isn't here right now. But if you'd like to make an appointment.
Now that must be a case as a writer where there was a happy marriage of your ideas and the director's execution of the ideas you discussed. It doesn't always go that way.
No.
But was there a point in the Batman process where you saw dailies or you saw an assembly and you knew this is one of the best versions of a director taking my words and us collaborating on what should be on screen?
Well, I think the two best versions of that I've had were Dark City and Batman Begins. Uh-huh. And the reason for that is because I developed both scripts with the director.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from the inception, the two of us were on board. So everything that Chris or Alex were going on to design was coming from that, as opposed to writing a script in a vacuum and then giving it to Norrington or Guillermo del Toro, even though I had a good experience with those guys.
Different.
And then interpreting it in a different way or coming at it from a different way. And that in both those cases, we were sort of approaching it from the same angle.
Right. Did you know when you saw the director's cut that this was going to work and reinvent the franchise?
I knew before then because we also started pre-production. Chris brought on his production designer as we were writing, and he worked in the room next to us. And we would just go back and forth, and he was coming up with designs for Gotham or the Batmobile, and we would come in kibitz. And then some of that would flood back into the script that we were writing. So the sort of visual evolution of the film was happening parallel to the script.
Yeah, I assume it's gone the other way for you.
I've had terrible experiences with directors.
When do you know with those experiences? Is it when you see the director's cut or before? Or just from
you know, sometimes when you're shooting and I've had experiences where the director, you realize with horror that the director actually doesn't understand the scene.
Right.
Like missed the whole point of the scene.
Right.
And you try to sort of talk sense into them or things like that. And, you know, that's bad. Also, it's bad if you have, I've a couple of times worked with directors where it kind of became a free for all and they would listen to anyone because they were terrified. So, I mean, yes, my voice was in there, but the studio and the committee, and it's just a mess.
Right. Where's your workspace? What do you work out of and what's in it?
I have an office at home and I do a lot of work there. And my sort of prized possession is a photograph in the 70s of Marlon Brando. And behind him is a paparazzi photographer named Ron Galila who used to stalk Marlon Brando. And at one point, Brando turned around and punched him in the face and broke his nose. So from that point onward, Ron wore a football helmet with his name Ron on it. So the photo is Marlon Brando with Ron and the football helmet behind him. And that kind of sums up Hollywood.
Oh, that's great.
To me completely.
The guy wants to punch the nose and the guy's figured out what to wear to protect
the
nose.
Then he's stalking him.
Right.
You know, but most of my scripts I write, the bulk of them, I always break the back of all my scripts at a place in Wyoming that I go up to in Jackson Hole. And I just lock myself away in this lodge for 10 or, you know, 15 days.
Has that evolved over time, that kind of writer's retreat for you?
Yeah, I realized it's just better to go away and just really focus.
Do you listen to music or have little rituals while you write or things?
I don't listen to music. I can't. I need complete silence. I can't even have anyone else in the house, much less the room. So there's that. I always write from about 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. I don't write on the weekends.
How important is that kind of discipline? Do you need that?
I think it's really important. I mean, some people write in different ways, but for me, you know, I think one of the reasons that I've been successful is that I created my own discipline and I'm very rigid about it and I treat it like a real job. And I found that once I started doing that, I became a more effective writer.
You mentioned you read a lot. The reading, does it help your writing? Do you read while you're writing or just like
I read
before you get inspired to write a screenplay?
I read while I'm writing and inevitably I find out, and it's obvious, it's usually subconsciously, but inevitably I will realize as I'm writing that there's certain thematic elements to what I've been reading or had selected to read, but it's not apparent to me until I'm sort of much further along in the process.
Right. You just kind of, you divine out the mood of what you're writing, stories or books present themselves.
Yeah. Like, or I'll be on Amazon and I don't realize it, but I'll be reading descriptions or reviews of books and ordering them. But clearly in the back of my head, they're thematically linked to whatever it is that I'm writing.
And you've been busy on originals for so long, but do you get called on to come in and rewrite other writers' screenplays?
Yeah, I've done a certain amount of what they refer to as script doctoring.
Right.
And it can be very fun because sometimes it's just a totally mercenary aspect to doing it where you come in for a week or two or three and your job isn't to rebuild the fort. Your job is to just...
Do the notes
or, you know, on one movie I was brought in merely to rewrite Michael Caine's dialogue. That's all I did is he played a villain and I was just making his dialogue snarkier.
Right.
And it's kind of fun because I think it's very pretentious to...
Wasn't he the villain in that Steven Seagal movie?
Why, yes, he was.
Was that possibly the...
That was possibly the one. The one that Steven Seagal, directed.
Right. His debut. What is it? Big Mountain Railroad or something? What was it called?
It was Escape to Witch Mountain. That's what it was. It was called On Deadly Ground.
On Deadly Ground.
Because that's the other
He's
thing.
He's got the Indian muumuu on.
Yeah, and all of his movies at the time had
Indian American
three,
Indian, that
three
Indian,
words.
Indian. Right.
On Deadly Ground, Above the Law, Hard to Kill, March for Death.
Have you ever turned down a rewrite job because you respect the original writer? Or
yeah, absolutely. I was actually approached possibly to rewrite Spider-Man from David Koepp's script. And
The new one.
The first.
Oh, Spider-Man. I'm sorry. This is the first Spider-Man.
Yeah. About. Okay. And I thought his script was really good. And I told him, you guys are crazy. Like, you shouldn't rewrite it. And that happens a lot. I've also turned down jobs because I've been asked to rewrite friends' work.
Right.
Or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But, I've been rewritten by people.
That was my next question.
And then I've gone on to rewrite them. And it's, once you're in this business long enough that that kind of stuff happens.
Why the musical chair so much, you think, on scripts and big
because
movies?
It's... On one hand, stuff can be developed and can be helped, but I also maintain, I swear to God, I wish one day, for 1 year, Hollywood would only make first drafts.
Right.
And I maintain that films would be no better or worse.
Right.
And they'd probably save a lot of money in development, but sometimes they get better.
Right.
But I always feel that in the development process, maybe by the third or fourth draft, they get better, but then there's sort of a law of diminishing returns and then they're not as good again.
Yeah.
And I think the main reason is, it's twofold. One, it's inevitable that as an executive or a producer reads a script for the third or fourth time, it doesn't feel as fresh anymore.
Right.
And so...
You get the note, this doesn't feel as fresh anymore.
Exactly. And you're like, well, duh, because you know what all the scares are. You know what the jokes are. You don't have that experience. And there's that, but it's also... It's the only real element that can change, that can be continually fucked with.
Right.
Once you're shooting the movie,
the train's left the station.
So it's the obvious place for the studio to second guess themselves
because they can, and it gives you that false sense of security.
It's mutable,
right?
And there's also a sense of, well, this script is great, but if we bring on high-paid screenwriter X for a punch-up,
we did what we could,
and we protected ourselves, and maybe he gave it that little pixie dust. But a lot of times then people just go in and kind of phone it in.
Right.
So.
How do you approach receiving notes from executives or producers or managers or actors or like? Are you pretty open-minded, or have the years kind of built up a healthy cynicism about it all?
I try to be open-minded, even though by nature I'm very cynical about it.
Right.
But I do try to be open-minded, and I do try to listen. A lot of times it's just about them being heard.
Right.
A lot of times you can talk people out of notes, you know, and sometimes you get good notes. But nowadays, I'm much more in the position of being able to pick the people that I'm working with.
Right.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So the producers or the directors and right. so, you know,
as much as you can agree on.
Even the executives.
Right.
So there's a bit more of a safety factor there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think genre films have to fight to get the same respect as the
yeah.
other? Even though there's this mad rush to make more genre pictures and bigger tentpole movies.
And certainly the most successful films of all time have been
right.
science fiction or fantasy.
There seems to be a weird paradox of, in a way, those screenplays need to be better crafted than something taking place in the real world because you have to do so much heavy lifting to suspend disbelief and make it believable.
Well, that, there is that. Obviously, there's a suspension. You're dealing with that suspension of disbelief is a factor that you don't have to deal with if you're doing Fried Green Tomatoes or if you're doing, you know, I don't know, American
right.
Beauty or something like that. Will we ever see a science fiction film nominated for Best Picture?
Right. I remember when Silence of the Lambs got Best Picture, it was a horror
deal.
Film won Best Picture.
Well, and also when Sigourney Weaver as actress was nominated for Aliens, mm-hmm. that was a giant deal.
Right. Do you think they're still kind of looked down upon?
Yeah, absolutely. They absolutely are.
Do you ever look at, when you're constructing a script, do you put monologues or action description that you feel is going to help hook an actor or hook a director? Do you think that's possible
yeah.
to do at all?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you have to do that.
Right.
And especially if you know that you're going out to a certain star.
Right.
Sometimes you'll take an extra little pass and try to, I remember on Blade 2, for instance, Wesley Snipes hates getting wet. And we had the sequence where we wanted Blade to fall into a vat of blood and become totally submerged in it and then walk out covered in blood.
Right.
Kind of a problem. Wesley doesn't like to be wet. And I had this bet with Peter Frankfurt and Guillermo del Toro, producer and director. They said, you're never going to get it in the movie. He's not going to do it.
Right.
And I said, I can get him to do it. So I went back and rewrote the scene. And the description is just adjective, florid, florid. And I said, and he emerges from the blood, looking so like some primordial god of war. And I actually wrote in the description, not unlike Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. I swear to God.
This means you, Wesley.
Yes,
read closely.
Yeah. You are Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. You are the primordial
right.
god of war. And sure enough, he agreed to do it.
Right.
So.
Sneaky, but
we,
it works.
Yeah, we do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I joke that like every description of like a leading lady is always like, attractive yet fiercely intelligent.
Right. She's got to be Mensa, but she also has to know karate.
Yeah.
Now, if I remember correctly, you have a nice balance between writing the action and the descriptions in your scripts to be entertaining, but they're not show-offy like some writers.
Well, I try not to be obnoxious.
Right. Now that you're directing your own scripts, will you write the prose to be less?
Yeah.
Because you're already
yeah.
there.
Partially when you're writing a script, you are trying to attract a director and or stars. But if I am the director,
right.
you know,
I know what you're doing.
There's less kind of hootenanny involved, you know, verbal hootenanny. But I will also change my writing style depending on the movie.
Right.
So Zigzag, the independent film I did, was written very sparsely. The Blade films were a bit more florid
yeah.
and kind of in your face in terms of the prose style. Batman was written. I literally went back and read scripts for Lawrence of Arabia, Man Who Would Be King.
Oh, wow.
Because we were trying to ape that feeling of this sort of classic epic.
Right.
I tried to write Batman Begins in a more sort of classic mannered style.
Yeah, what was the main difference between those screenplays from that time and even screenplays of epics today? Like, were they written in a more minimalist style?
Yeah, and they weren't showy.
Right.
And there was no kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Hey, we know you're
right.
a highly paid studio executive that's reading this.
Right.
You know, they were approached much more in a no-nonsense way. I remember when I was first starting out, I was very impressed with Walter Hill's early scripts, like the scripts for...
Well, The Driver was a great...
The Driver and Hard Times, and they were just like these, like almost haikus because they were so sparse.
What's the Long Riders is very sparse.
And, you know, I was very impressed with those scripts.
And that's the direction you and
Chris initially,
went.
That's the direction I went in. And then I realized that I would change it up depending on what the movie was.
Right. Do you intimidate people in meetings, the people that aren't familiar with you? They just know the body of work. And then, who's this dark guy coming in to see me?
Yeah, and sometimes the tattoos. It's funny that I get that because I think I'm relatively affable.
You're one of the nicest guys in the business.
I think I am. But, you know, I've had people, be freaked out.
Judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
Do you use that ever to your
advantage? Of course. Make them fear you.
Right. Have you ever had...
There's nothing that will scare them more than just not saying much.
Just letting it hang.
Yeah, just nodding or something like that.
Aside from just having the talent itself, what can't be taught about screenwriting? Or what's the one piece of...
Tenacity.
Tenacity.
Yeah, and having a hard skin because, you know, it's not enough, unfortunately, to be talented in this business because it's such a social business.
Right.
And so much of it is not only the work, but getting in the room and convincing these people that not only are you the right guy to write this, but that, you know, they're developing so many movies, hundreds, thousands of movies at the given studios, and they're only going to make 12 to 25 a year.
Right.
And so for every script of yours, they're going to make your script. They're not going to make 100 others.
Right.
And they're going to spend, in the case of Blade, $60 million on the movie and another $30 million, $100 million, marketing. And that's a lot of money. A lot of people's careers are hanging in the balance in terms of making the right decision. So your job is also with the script or whatever you're conveying personally is, not only should you not make those movies, you should make mine and your career is going to advance because of it. Because to make even the smallest movie like Zig Zag, it's millions of dollars riding on it. Right. It's not the same as just publishing some small book or something.
Right. So now it's not enough to just bring in the material that's commercial and that they can say, is going to be a hit movie. It has to be personalized into this will advance your career.
Yeah, you terrified guys that are, because it's mostly a studio executive's job to say no.
Right.
Because anytime you say yes,
right,
your career's on the line.
The law of averages is with you if you say no.
Exactly. So if you say, I believe in this one, you're on the hook for it.
Right.
So your job as the writer or director or whatever is to somehow communicate to studio executive A, B, or C.
Right.
Dude, you're going to get a nice bonus if you do this.
Right. Do you think, I know I love horror films, you love horror films. I'm enjoying the fantasy films that are getting made now. Are we in danger of burning it out?
Nah, it'll be cyclical.
Right.
I mean, I think these genres are perennial.
Right.
And everybody will jump on the bandwagon like they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, comic book films, in a year or two that this cycle will burn itself out and it'll go more dormant. And then it'll come back again.
Right. I mean, now the most famous characters have kind of been adapted, I guess, unless sequels to those films, that launched the new franchises. Do you think people will start looking for the hidden gems like Blade?
They will, but then, 20 years from now, they'll probably do another cycle of Superman films and Batman films and Lone Ranger films.
Right.
And, I think those characters are sort of cultural icons that are just here to stay.
Right. Why do you think they endure? It's a uniquely American kind of invention, these characters that came from pulpy, like nickel escapist comic books during the Depression days.
Know. They have resonance. Mm-hmm. They stood the test of time, and Batman and Superman have been around for 75 odd years, something like that. And if a character can survive through that many permutations, there's something about it. I mean, Superman is the Christ myth.
Right.
I mean, literally.
My only son saved.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a godlike being. I'm going to send him down to save you, and he's going to suffer for you. It's Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of obvious why that one endures. And Batman is sort of the ultimate kind of dark wish fulfillment thing. It's terribly romantic. It's got their antecedents to vampire stories and
it's
things
tragic.
Like that. Phantom of the Opera, stuff like that.
Why do you think horror films are doing bigger business now than they have in a long time? The Grudge and the Japanese remakes.
I think it's cyclical. Mm-hmm. It's just people like to be scared. They go in and out of fashion. And, I think in another couple of years, that'll abate. And they will become dormant again for a while. And I just think, every generation or every other generation, there's going to be a cycle of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And people will come up. also, the public has a very short memory.
Right.
You know, everything old is new again.
Right.
And people don't realize that films being made now, you know, they have all these forefathers and films being made 20 years ago and right. 40 years ago and things like that.
Now, after the film you're about to direct,
The Invisible,
after that, you think Flash will be next for you?
Probably, yeah.
And then when can we expect the next Batman in release?
Probably 2008, summer 2008. We're just talking about it, trying to figure out what the hell, can we do it? Can it be cool again? That kind of thing.
Well, excellent. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
We want to thank David Goyer, director, writer, producer. Thank you as well. Please be sure to check out our other great interviews. And remember, it all starts with you. The next written by credit could be yours. I'm Mike DeLuca.
I hope you guys enjoyed that sneak preview of the dialogue with David Goyer. And if you want to watch this on Indie Film Hustle TV, all you got to do is go to indiefilmhustle.tv and sign up. And there you can watch another 32 episodes of this amazing series, as well as tons of other courses, movies, documentaries, all about filmmaking and screenwriting. Again, that's indiefilmhustle.tv. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/220. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.